Welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 77, Boston's 1968 Tent City Protest. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss an act of civil disobedience by residents of one Boston neighborhood that helped change how the city approaches development and urban planning. A group of South End community leaders, mostly African-American residents, occupied an empty lot where row houses once stood, bringing attention to the city's need for affordable housing. It was Boston's 1968 Tent City Protest, and the 50th anniversary is coming up this week. But before we talk about Tent City, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
For our featured historic site this week, we want to send you to a small museum that serves as the tombstone for a bygone neighborhood and as a cautionary tale about unrestrained development. The West End was once a vibrant neighborhood hugging the banks of the Charles from about the Charles MGH T station to the TD Garden, neither of which, of course, existed yet at that time. Before Boston was expanded by filling the salt marshes that surrounded the Shawmut Peninsula, the West End was separated from the North End by a lagoon, and from the rest of Boston by sparsely populated Beacon Hill. In the early 19th century, it was home to a free black community. Later in the 19th and the early 20th centuries, it became home to a dazzling array of new immigrants from all over the world. New arrivals from Ireland, Italy, Armenia, Greece, and Syria all called the area home. In the 20th century, the West End was the most densely populated district of the city, and Eastern European Jews were the most populous ethnic group behind the Irish, with 7 synagogues. Many residents loved the neighborhood, but the city government considered it a blighted slum. On April 11, 1953, Mayor Hines and the Boston Housing Authority announced that the only way to save the West End was to destroy it. The neighborhood, almost a third of the original colonial landmass of Boston, would be leveled. Bland residential towers would replace it. 2,700 families were displaced, and only 477 new apartments would be built. Today, in a small commercial space in one of the large modern buildings that replaced the tenements of the old West End, a museum carries on the memory of what was lost. Founded in 2003, the West End Museum's permanent exhibit is called The Last Tenement, which was originally developed for the old State House Museum and traces the immigrant period of the West End. 2 more galleries house rotating exhibits that highlight the history of development in Boston. Right now, one of the rotating exhibits highlights the New York Streets neighborhood, part of the South End that fell victim to a similar fate as the West End. The West End Museum is located at 150 Staniford Street, just down the block from TD Garden. It's open Tuesday through Friday from noon to 5 p.m., and on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's an easy walk from North Station, or there are parking garages nearby.
And for our upcoming event this week, the Historical Society of Watertown is hosting an interesting-sounding event on May 17th. Author and librarian Corinne Smith will present a talk called Mom's World War II Letters, with an accompanying slideshow. Here's how the Historical Society describes it. In May 2017, Corinne Smith found her mother's stash of more than 100 letters from the 16 servicemen with whom she corresponded from 1944 to 1945. Most of the men were from Allentown, Pennsylvania, or Trenton, New Jersey. Corinne began to trace the soldiers' family trees with one goal in mind: to return the letters in person to their children. She started a Mom's World War II Letters blog to document this project. The presentation will link history and genealogy to present-day research and diligence. It will revisit a time that we may not want to forget, and may prompt others to wonder for themselves what treasures lurk in their old family boxes and how the information can be shared with others. The event will be held at Watertown Public Library at 123 Main Street in Watertown Square. We used to live near Watertown Square, and the library was one of our favorite hangouts with plenty of sunny nooks for reading. The program begins at 7 p.m., it's free, and no registration is required. We'll have a link to more information in this week's show notes. With that, it's time to turn to this week's main topic.
April 1968 was a tumultuous time in Boston and across the country. After Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed on April 4th, anger turned to rioting in many cities. Boston was spared the worst of the violence, due in no small part to a concert played by James Brown at Boston Garden the next night. As we heard from Ryan Walsh in episode 70, the show was broadcast live on WGBH and then immediately replayed, in the hopes that people would stay home and watch, rather than take to the streets in protests that might turn violent. Brown and Mayor Kevin White took to the stage with a message of unity, asking Bostonians to honor King's vision through their actions. In the meantime, nobody was sure what the future held for Dr. King's vision of a more just nation, and for his nonviolent means. In the final years of his life, he had moved beyond advocating for desegregation and racial equality, and taken up the issue of poverty and social justice more broadly. In early 1968, he began what he called the Poor People's Campaign, a national effort to improve the lives and opportunities for poor people of all races, with a focus on affordable housing, full employment, and even a guaranteed basic income. After Dr. King was assassinated, a Poor People's Campaign event he had envisioned went forward in May. Thousands of activists erected a shantytown on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. that they called Resurrection City, and which they occupied for 6 weeks to draw attention to the plight of the nation's poorest citizens. Resurrection City may have been inspired, at least in part, by a protest in Boston's South End a month before. By 1968, Boston residents had been dealing with the process of urban renewal for over a decade. After World War II, the predominant American culture made suburbanization a central value, viewing cities as morally suspect. Urban renewal was the process by which entire neighborhoods were seized by eminent domain and bulldozed to make space for large developments. The impacted neighborhoods tended to be low-income communities, and often communities of color, where the residents didn't have the political clout to prevent the destruction. In Boston, the agency tasked with planning and carrying out urban renewal was the Boston Redevelopment Authority. It was created by an act of the legislature in 1957 and authorized to buy, sell, and take land by eminent domain, working on behalf of large developers to consolidate control of real estate from small property holders and open it for construction. Even before the BRA was created, the South End was the first neighborhood to be disrupted by a large-scale urban renewal project led by the Boston Housing Authority. Between Harrison Avenue and Albany Street in the South End stood a neighborhood called the New York Streets. It was about 12 city blocks or 24 acres, crisscrossed by Troy, Rochester, Genesee, Oswego, Oneida, and Seneca Streets. The Boston and Albany Railroad Terminal was nearby, and the adjacent streets were named after towns in upstate New York that the railroad passed through. In 1955, the city took the land under the neighborhood and moved all the residents out. Some were relocated to housing far from their friends and family in the South End. Others weren't provided with alternative housing at all. The neighborhood was replaced by the headquarters of the Boston Herald and other, smaller factories, which was seen as a better use for the space than as home for over 1,000 people who were now displaced. After the New York Streets, the entire West End fell under the BRA's wrecking balls. Soon, the Castle Square neighborhood was also razed, and plans were laid to knock down more South End neighborhoods. The impact of urban renewal fell disproportionately on communities of color. Many African Americans complained to the BRA and urban renewal's impact on their communities, using a term that was considered polite at the time but isn't anymore. The common refrain was, "Urban renewal means Negro removal." These offenses drew the attention of a new generation of leaders, such as Mel King.
Mel King, no relation to Dr. King, was the son of immigrants. After growing up in Boston, he attended college at a historically black college in South Carolina before returning to Boston and teaching in the city's public schools. He left the school system to work with at-risk youth in the South End settlement houses. Having witnessed the impact of the New York Streets Project, his childhood neighborhood, he founded a group called Community Action for a United South End, or CAUSE, which would attempt to give residents control over the BRA and the urban renewal process. Mel King and CAUSE would be tested in 1968 when outgoing fire commissioner Bill Fitzgerald bought a group of brick row houses and bulldozed them into a parking lot. In his book, Chain of Change, King describes the Fitz Inn parking lot, bounded by Dartmouth, Columbus, and Yarmouth streets, directly across from my house. The lot was the site of a choice parcel of land, which had been earmarked for development by the BRA. Its sound, handsome brick row houses had been raised, and the lots paved over for parking until the resale value would net enough profit to suit the owner. This site was the fact and the symbol of all we had been fighting against for so long. About 100 families were displaced when the existing residential buildings were demolished, without providing adequate alternative housing for those who had to move. As a symbolic act of resistance against the BRA and urban renewal, about 30 members of CAUSE occupied the BRA's South End offices on April 26, 1968. They nailed the door shut and refused to grant entry to Mayor White. The protest wound down at 6 that same evening, with police escorting the protesters out of the building. That first day of direct action inspired the group to do more. On April 28th, activists from CAUSE went down to the new parking lot at the corner of Dartmouth and Columbus. Early in the morning, they parked cars blocking each entrance. As commuters began arriving to, as Mel King puts it, park on the grave of a neighborhood block, activists pressed flyers into their hands that said, "Dear Parker, this paper is an attempt to tell you why this parking lot has been closed by CAUSE. It is simple. South End people want to live in decent homes at reasonable rent. No housing has been built. People have been moved, of course. Housing should be built here on this land, so your cars will no longer park here." An activist explained the reason for the protest to a reporter from WHDH.
It doesn't seem that the BRA has any direction here. Now, we see a lot of demolition, and the people are concerned on whether they're going to be able to remain here or return here. They have rumors that it's going to be high-rent, high-rise apartments. They're concerned about this. Now, this particular parking lot that they've picked out to shut off this morning is one that has been growing in the South End over the years. I understand that the gentleman who owns it has been acquiring the property here, and the citizens are concerned on whether they'll be able to return back into the housing that will be built.
Traffic quickly snarled, with cars backed up to Copley Square and beyond. For some reason, nothing makes the average American as angry as having protesters tie up traffic. Recent examples abound. Here in Boston, Black Lives Matter activists chained themselves together and to concrete blocks in January of 2015, bringing I-93 to a standstill. In any comment section, you'll see something along the lines of, "Well, next time, the people who are late for work should just run over those losers." That sentiment festered on the right for long enough to lead to the death of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville last summer, as a car driven by a far-right protester encountered traffic blocked by a crowd and simply drove into them.
The tensions on Dartmouth Street reached a similar boiling point that April morning, and lives were perhaps saved by the simple fact that drivers couldn't get up a head of steam to drive into the crowd at speed. Mel King recounts what happened when one driver was driven to the breaking point. "As we stood at one entrance to the lot, one driver became so angry that he drove into the crowd, knocking me down. Another demonstrator retaliated by grabbing the car's antenna, and there was the threat of a real fight." About 50 police officers responded to the disturbance. One news account quoted the officer in charge as saying, "Mr. King, I believe in your CAUSE and I am with you, but I have a job to do. Clear the area." King continues, "For 15 minutes there was a general uproar, and in the process of being shoved into police vans, we at least managed to bring the morning commuter traffic throughout the area to a standstill. 23 of us were arrested." The altercation provided police with a pretense for clearing the lot. After they were arrested, all the protesters were released on their own recognizance. Other than the time and inconvenience of being arrested and processed, the worst punishment meted out was a $15 fine to Mel King and some of the other leaders of the group. The experience galvanized the protesters, as heard in this news footage from WHDH that evening.
"His attitude was such that he was practically dripping venom from that truck. He stopped. He had a chance to recoup. his senses, but he didn't. Then he charged ahead again and hit two more people.
Mr. Rollins, what do you think the reaction of the community will be to this incident this morning and their continued fight against the BRA?
I think that we're going to have an accelerated and a greatly expanded fight against the BRA. This project must be stopped. There's no question about it. And it's the only question is whether we go back onto the street tomorrow and Sunday and Monday, and whether we have to go to jail again, and whether we have to face those police again and do whatever is necessary to stop the project. There'll be many, many more people involved now. There'll be, I think, a great deal more pressure coming to bear on the Boston Redevelopment Authority from various political sources, on our Mayor Kevin White, to stop that project, to reevaluate what's been happening, and to develop it in a way that it takes into consideration essentially the needs of people as opposed to the needs of property owners.
The next day, activists returned to the parking lot. This time, the protest was a lot larger. The core group was between 100 and 400 people, and they quickly erected tents, wooden shanties, and other shelters, some of which were designed by architecture students from MIT who decided to lend a hand. A report written 10 years later described how the city went up. The people of Tent City built symbolic housing from all available materials, discarded crates, old signs, and tents. As more people arrived, the settlement grew. Some people built a city hall, others built a medical center, and still others constructed an interdenominational religious structure. Periodically, community leaders would announce the results of the latest negotiations with the city officials. There were strings of Christmas lights, charcoal grills, and a sign welcoming people to Tent City. Thousands of curious onlookers came to the site to listen to the music that poured out of saxophones and guitars. The protesters shared the burgers and dogs they were grilling up. Celtics legend Bill Russell owned a restaurant in the South End called Slade's, and he sent over huge trays of food to feed the residents of Tent City and their curious visitors alike. In a move that was echoed a generation or two later by the Occupy Boston protest, the members of Cause announced that they were in it for the long haul. They planned to stay camped on the parking lot until the city was willing to make concessions and provide more affordable housing in the South End. To avoid any charges of indecency, only men were allowed to stay in the campsite overnight. Of course, today, we know that isn't a guarantee that there won't be any indecency. But at the time, it was seen as a good way to avoid giving the police an excuse to move in and clear the camp.
Unlike 2011's Occupy encampment, which lasted almost 2.5 months, the Tent City protest was over after just 3 nights. On the morning of April 30th, police moved in again and ordered protesters to clear the area. Most protesters complied, though the reasons seemed to have gotten lost or confused in the intervening years. Detractors said that organizers were paid off, with a donation from the Episcopal Diocese of Boston to the tune of $10,000 helping to change their minds. Mel King called the decision to accept that donation the biggest mistake the organizers made, saying it led to strife among his organization as they attempted to decide how to use the money. Some organizers say that they felt that their point had been made. Other accounts say that the camp had been infiltrated by undercover police, and they had to break up the camp before arrests started. Was it effective? As a news anchor at the time said,
"A homesteader's office, a church, a public works department, a soup kitchen, and other niceties is no more. Whether it speeded the day that real dwellings will go up here is open to question. The record is not yet closed." This is Andy McMillan reporting from Tent City.
It would take another 20 years to close the record on the Tent City protest. In the immediate weeks and months after the protest, Mel King and Cause organized more short-term occupations of vacant land around the city. He recollects, "It was our intention to keep moving and not get caught in situations we had to maintain. We wanted to highlight and dramatize and keep the offensive. After each event, we planned the next." The strategy was still on his mind in 2011 when he criticized the Occupy Boston movement for being too attached to the physical location of their encampment in Dewey Square, telling the Boston Globe, "I don't believe it's in their interest to make staying on that land the defining aspect of what they're trying to do. They need to pick a couple of targets and go after them." Mel King and Cause may have picked many targets for brief protest occupations in the wake of the Tent City, but they were really focused on a narrow set of goals. They wanted more housing, especially affordable housing, to be available in low-income neighborhoods, and they wanted the communities that would be affected by the Boston Redevelopment Authority's actions to have a decision-making role within the BRA. That spring, their activism seemed to have tangible results. An ally on the city council got a resolution passed that urged a new direction for the BRA's relationship with neighborhoods. Number one, an urban renewal body be elected by residents. Number two, the election be an official city election. Number three, the BRA be directed to undertake renewal activities only with the approval of the elected body. And number four, the elected body be delegated the power to subcontract renewal functions and to interest itself in all issues of concern to the South End. That success was quickly reversed over the summer when the council passed another resolution changing the role of the elected committee from decision-making to review. The BRA then made an administrative ruling that the committee's decisions should not be considered binding.
By the spring of 1969, anger was building again. The BRA rebuffed the demands of activists to honor the original terms of the elected committee, refusing the community to have a voice in how their neighborhood would be redeveloped. There was no movement on almost 1,300 units of affordable housing that had been promised the previous year, and the BRA continued to demolish what Cause and other groups considered to be viable buildings in the South End. On the first anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death, Mel King reported that, "We faced the question of whether Dr. King's nonviolent tactics were viable, or whether the frustration of black and poor people in Boston would reach the explosion point before white agencies saw any point at all in listening to or responding to our needs." Progress, when it came, was slow. In the summer of 1969, the Tent City Task Force was organized to begin a planning process that involved the community. Starting in 1970, the South End community finally got an official voice in the BRA planning process, with the South End Project Area Committee. According to a summary from the City Archives, CPAC could initiate, review, and suggest changes in proposals, veto sponsors and developers, review and approve demolition plans, form committees for special proposals, sponsor legislation and ordinances, enter into contracts, and negotiate with the City of Boston through appropriate agencies. CPAC members were elected every 2 years at elections conducted by the city's election department. The first issue of the CPAC newsletter reports on the realization of one of the goals Cause and the Tent City protesters were advocating for. In one of its first actions, CPAC voted to suspend demolition on all buildings so that a careful study could be made. Only those buildings that cannot be rehabilitated for housing would be recommended for demolition. By that summer, 1,100 units of affordable housing were under construction in the South End, and the BRA and HUD were making grants to South End residents to rehabilitate their existing homes. Despite this slow and steady transformation, some things remained unchanged. On April 28, 1978, South End residents staged a sit-in at the BRA headquarters, holding signs accusing the agency of promoting broken buildings and broken promises. According to a report published later that year, the next day, they marked a decade of civic inaction since the Tent City protest. On April 29th, they reenacted the neighborhood's taking over of the parking lot, and through the day, people gathered on the site, readdressing the issues of concern to the community. The dislocation of residents through real estate speculation, the need for low and moderate income housing on Tent City site, and the reaffirmation of CPAC's role in representing the community in negotiations with the BRA. Mel King would be elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives in 1972. By the time he published the book Chain of Change in 1981, the Tent City protest was still unfinished business. He looked back on April 1968 and said, "We chose this site because the decent housing that existed there was torn down. Today, after 12 years, this site is still used as a parking lot." Later in 1981, WGBH reflected on the challenges that almost brought the quest for affordable housing on the site to an end.
When we last showed you the tent city site earlier this spring, it was being blocked by protesters, angry over another snag that had developed in the decade-long struggle to build low-income housing on this site. It seems that the owners of the parking lot, the politically connected family of former Boston Fire Commissioner William Fitzgerald, had pulled out of partnership negotiations with the community-based Tent City Corporation. And it looked for a while like the low-income housing might just go down the tubes.
After the Fitzgeralds pulled out of the deal, we had to then find a way of coming up with the money because the BRA said that they didn't have the funds to do eminent domain. And that seemed to be the issue at hand with why the Fitzgeralds and Tent City came together.
In the intervening years, development came to the parcels surrounding the parking lot at the corner of Dartmouth Street and Columbus Ave. By 1976, the shadow of the gleaming 60-story John Hancock Tower fell on the lot. Well, it wasn't exactly gleaming yet. For the first few years, plywood panels replaced much of the glass facade, but that's another story for another podcast. Facing the parcel across the Southwest Corridor, a rail right-of-way that has since been transformed into a park that's one of the city's best-kept secrets, a high-end mall called Copley Place was completed by 1983. It wasn't until the administration of Mayor Ray Flynn that the idea of affordable housing on the Tent City site began to get traction. In 1985, the BRA entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Tent City Corporation and Copley Place developer UIDC that would result in the construction of both an underground parking garage for shoppers and commuters, as well as a mixed-income housing development. The key points were, number one, UIDC will convey its parcels on the Tent City site to the authority at no cost to the authority. Number two, the BRA will lease to UIDC the subsurface rights to the entire site for 50% of net profits of the 698-space parking garage, which UIDC will construct there. Number three, the BRA will lease to Tent City the surface and air rights to the entire site for $1 per year for the construction of the 270 units of low, moderate, and market rate housing. Finally, in 1986, Mayor Flynn and Governor Michael Dukakis presided over an official groundbreaking ceremony at the former parking lot site on the corner of Dartmouth and Columbus. Flynn said, "Tent City once symbolized the city's inability to produce affordable housing. Today, it has become a different kind of symbol. It now represents an extraordinary effort of cooperation between city government, state government, the private sector, and residents of the South End, all of whom worked long and hard to see this project through. For the last 2 years, we have been determined to make Tent City work. We have had to be creative and resourceful, and we are now moving from an idea to reality of real housing at this site." The next year, WGBH reported as thousands of residents lined up at the leasing office to apply for a spot in the new buildings.
The doors opened at 10 this morning, and hundreds marched in. Young, old, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, poor, and not so poor. All of them seeking a place in this South End apartment complex, a glimmer of affordable housing in the shadow of upscale Copley Place. They call this project Tent City. The name stems from a protest held here in 1968. Back then, the area was leveled, and parking lots lied where apartments once stood. Demonstrators pitched tents on this corner and at other sites where low-cost housing was needed, and for 4 days in April, they camped out until the city agreed to take action. But that was 19 years ago, and this fall, only a portion of those who apply will be able to move in.
Finally, a ribbon-cutting ceremony on April 30th, 1988 marked the formal opening of the Tent City housing complex, with 269 units. It had taken 20 years since the BRA demolished the brownstones that used to stand on the corner, and 20 years since a cause protest temporarily shut down the parking lot that replaced them. But the dream of quality, affordable housing in the South End had become a reality. On the eve of the opening, Mel King and fellow activist Betty Meredith reflected on what they had achieved.
What we were saying is that the building ought to remain, and that the process should not allow people to get displaced from homes to house automobiles in a parking lot.
Really difficult to believe that it took this long, but it's worth it, isn't it? It's beautiful, and people have a place to live. Nice place to live.
According to an article by the New Jersey Institute of Technology, the units are a mix of 25% low income, 50% moderate income, and 25% market rate housing. According to architect John Clancy, the absence of any distinction between the market rate units and the other types has been successful partly because the location is very desirable. Clancy emphasized that location is very important to the success of housing for low-income people, and added that the provision of amenities for the wider community facilitated the integration of Tent City into the older social fabric. Ken Kruckmeyer, former board member of the Tent City Corporation, describes the characteristics that make the Tent City development a potential model for the future of mixed-income housing in Boston. The important success is that a very high-quality, mixed-income development has been created in the midst of an existing but gentrifying neighborhood. A strong stand to preserve the mix of income and races has been made, and it helps create a level of trust and tolerance among all. It's hard to draw a tidy conclusion from the story of the Tent City protests. Yes, activists succeeded in convincing the city to include affordable housing in the development that went up on the Tent City site, but it took 20 years to become a reality. Yes, current generations of urban planners seem to have learned from the mistakes that were made in early decades of urban renewal, but they still make mistakes. Yes, the Boston Redevelopment Authority has been rebranded as the Boston Planning and Development Agency, but it still wields unparalleled power in Boston, reports directly to the mayor, and has few checks on its authority from the residents of the city.
The cost of housing in Boston is now at a crisis for all but the most wealthy residents. Home prices and rent climb faster than incomes, and almost all new residential development focuses on the overheated market for luxury condos. The Bay State Banner cited a study released by the city last summer to summarize the problem. More than 21% of the city's renters spend over half of their income on housing. At any given time, roughly 40,000 residents are on the waitlist for Section 8 public housing. Moreover, citywide median housing costs rose by 36% between 2010, the end of the Great Recession, and 2015, and by even more in some outer neighborhoods. Housing costs shot up 38% in Dorchester, 43% in Chinatown, 50% in Mattapan, and 70% in Roxbury. Yes, developers probably need to keep building luxury towers to take the pressure off the top end of the housing market, but we need affordable housing and workforce housing. We need apartments for students and workers and tech bros, and condos for young families and downsizing retirees. The cost of housing is one of the greatest threats to the city as we know it, presenting a real danger that Boston will be hollowed out. What becomes of a city when the middle class can no longer afford to live there, leaving only the very rich in their luxury developments and the very poor in public housing? Perhaps if the city had taken the lessons of the Tent City protest to heart, the Boston Planning and Development Agency would be directed more by the needs of average Bostonians, and a solution for the crisis might be in sight.
Well, on that cheerful note, to learn more about the Tent City protests, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/077. We'll have a link to an overview published by Mass Humanities and a summary of urban renewal in the South End from the South End Historical Society. We'll have a few photos of the protest and about 8 minutes of video showing the creative structures that people built. We'll have links to the CPAC newsletter archive, a 1978 study of the site, and other records relating to the Tent City Corporation. If you can, you'll also want to check out a copy of Mel King's book, Chain of Change. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event. Don't forget that History Camp Boston on July 7th is your chance to meet and hang out with us. I'll be speaking as part of a podcasting panel that features some of the biggest names in history podcasting. Besides me, the panel is Mick Sullivan from The Past and the Curious, Edward O'Donnell from In the Past Lane, Liz Covart, who started Ben Franklin's World, and, of course, Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. We'll have stickers and other goodies for fans we get to meet, and there's always time to get to know one another between sessions. In addition, I'll be leading a very special tour of the Back Bay focused on the process of constructing a fancy neighborhood out of a stagnant salt marsh on the Sunday after History Camp. You can get the details, read about the other great sessions that'll be offered, and register to attend at historycamp.org/Boston.
If you want to tell us about your experiences with urban renewal or give us any other feedback on the show, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show. That's all for now. We'll be back next week.